Hello and welcome to Series 3 of Tell Dem, a podcast hosted by The Masher in partnership with Transmission Roundhouse, generously funded by the Paul Hamlin Foundation.
This series, we're shifting things around a bit, bringing you bold and unfiltered discussions around decolonising theatre.
Every episode, we'll be joined by amazing theatre makers from the global majority, discussing power structures, global influencers,
what they do, how they do it, why they do it.
We're your hosts, Gidiga
and Beth,
and you are tuning into episode number 3. This podcast contains themes that listeners may find disturbing, triggering, or uncomfortable.
Reach out to me.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
And welcome back to episode 3 of series 3 of Tamasha's Tell Dem podcast. We are here to talk today to Kane Husbands and Nathan Powell. We get into some really deep conversations about what leadership look like, what responsibility looks like, how we work with audiences and artists.
And also what success looks like. And also Kane and Nathan share with us their goals for the future.
Do you want to give a little update on Shift maybe and
how
it's all going?
Shift update. Yeah, of course. So here's a little Shift update. So we're in June right now. And the last update to give you, or the latest update to give you, is that we've been chatting with regional theatres across the country who are now looking to commit to being part of Shift as a programme. And we're trying to create something which is called a regional hub. What we're doing at the moment is trying to establish a good, solid, strong relationship with theatre partners within a specific region to start to realise and dream up what these regional hubs would look like and what they will offer for their local artists.
Great.
Let's meet our guests. We've got some gorgeous guests with us today, including Kane Husbands and Nathan Powell.
Hello.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
So we have here Nathan Powell, who is originally from London and now living in Liverpool. He's a director and writer for theatre, making new work that invites people into theatres. And you can regularly find him creating work with young people. Nathan is currently the artistic director at the National Student Drama Festival and is the incoming creative director for Liverpool Everyman and Playhouse Theatres. And most recently, you could find him directing The Mountaintop by Katori Hall at the Leicester Curve. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And also congratulations on your appointment, Nathan, for Liverpool Everyman. Very exciting.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, man. Yeah, I'm buzzing.
Fantastic news for Liverpool and the Northwest. So we've got here Kane Husbands. Hey, Kane.
Hello.
Kane is from Birmingham and now based in London. He is the founder and artistic director of The Pappy Show and also a course leader for the BA in Performance Design Practice at Central St. Martin's. He's a facilitator, a director, performer and maker specialising in movement. And his work is often site-specific and seen on stage and on screen. Some of his credits include choreography for the London Olympics. He's worked across venues such as National Theatre, Chichester and Nottingham, to name just a few. And he's currently in an R&D for The Pappy Show's next big show, which is looking at community healing. That sounds so fun. Hope we get to hear a little bit more.
Yeah, thank you.
That sounds brilliant. We're going to kick off with the first question that we ask everybody, which is, what piece of culture, or not culture, could be anything, inspired you this week? So should we kick off with Kane?
Hello.
What inspired you this week?
It's been a big week, actually, because it's the final week at Central St. Martin's, which is the summer showcase. So every course showcases all of their work. So the whole of that Granary Square building turns into like an exhibition space. And it's like walking around the Tate or whatever. So I've just seen so much art, and it's really inspiring to go, this is what our university contributes to the art world this year. So I've been amazed by the work our students have done. And I guess if you're having taught them for 3 years, you then hope that over to you, let's see what you do. And I've just been amazed by how they've organized audiences, how they've kind of gathered people, how they've created work that's really political, that speaks to our times. And so I've seen so much, but yeah, I haven't been outside of that building much this week, but seen lots there.
Brilliant. And we'll throw the same question over to you, Nathan. What has inspired you this week?
Yeah, my one's close to home, so I hope this doesn't embarrass Gitika too much. But Gitika has just directed a show called Tell Me How It Ends at the Everyman Theatre in Liverpool, where I'll be joining soon. And I went and I watched that show, and it was just the most gorgeous, like, heartbreaking, funny, wonderful piece of art and theatre that Gitika and that team made and put together in a really short period of time as well. So yeah, I just walked away from that feeling like inspired by the work that I saw, but also really inspired about the buildings that I was about to enter and be a part of this next chapter of the Liverpool Everyman and Playhouse. So yeah, to kick off that journey by watching the work that Gitika made in that room for those people and at that time, just yeah, felt really inspiring and powerful and wonderful in every sense of the word. So yeah,
thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
That was gorgeous.
Nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, that's lovely. Beth, what inspired you this week?
What inspired me this week? I've been sort of, going over in my head what inspired me this week. Springwatch. I've been watching a lot of Springwatch, actually.
What's that?
So Springwatch is it's on the BBC. It's like they do like an hour every evening where they basically just look really in depth at like nature and the natural world for a whole hour on TV and like
David Attenborough kind of vibe.
Well, no, it's like a live program. So they literally, it's with like Chris Packham and Michaela Strachan, and they basically like they have like live cams on nest boxes, so you're like watching blue tits like basically become blue tits over like 2 weeks and like all the dramas that are going on. There was this one bit about like these pond snails. And I was like, oh my God, this is like all of this going on in the pond.
I could so imagine you doing that job.
Yeah.
You would be so good presenting.
What's the drama with the pond snails? I want to like, take us through the story.
Drama with the pond snails, well, they're born like with soft shells. And so they have to like develop these techniques to avoid being eaten by the other like hungry insects in the pond. And they have these bubbles that help them in their shells that help them like go up and down inside the pond. And then they just sit on the surface of the pond like for ages to try and avoid being eaten. Yeah, like so much detail. But I love, yeah, I just love
happy
it.
Happy show next show, yeah, okay?
Yeah.
That's the healing project.
And how about you?
My head's been in that show that Nathan was talking about, to be fair. Well, he just come up for air.
What's it about?
So it's a piece of new writing about, it's set in the 80s, around the AIDS epidemic, and it's a two-hander. So there's a gay man and a lesbian woman, and he's got HIV, and it's the story of their friendship, where they become sort of platonic soulmates over his 4 years. And then it's called Tell Me How It Ends, because I think you probably know how it ends. But the story is truly about living and not surviving, because there was a huge movement in the Northwest where a lot of lesbian women helped gay men and like sat by their bedsides. And so it was sort of highlighting the great work that a lot of women did that often gets forgotten, actually, and I didn't even know about it. So that's what the show's about. And the thing that inspired me this week was because I've been in at the Everyman, been hanging out with loads of young queer people in Liverpool, and they are super inspiring. And we had guest night the other night, and it was just full of young queer people buzzing around the theatre, all of their energy. But also what inspired me about them was just how like confident a lot of them are, and like how it just feels like they're really sure of who they are as people and so young. And that's so beautiful to see, especially as a queer person who came out really late. I think I came out in my late 20s. And I was speaking to 17-year-olds who were like, this is who I am. This is my pronouns. This is my partner, blah, blah, blah. And it's just so inspiring. I'm just like, wow, I wish I had that confidence then to even know who I was myself back then. So, yeah, big up to those guys.
That sounds incredible. Yeah.
Well done.
Thanks.
Yeah, yeah. It's really nice to get to celebrate someone in this room and the work that you've made. So yeah, really.
Cheers,
really
guys. Nice. Let's celebrate these two now. Yeah. So we've got two amazing artists, but also two amazing leaders that go hand in hand. And I wanted to kick off with the first sort of question or provocation for this particular episode. And that is, what does that word even mean to both of you? What does leadership mean? And I'm going to go really quiet and someone's going to say something.
I'll say something.
I knew you would.
Just wait out.
I was waiting.
It's a really a question. Yeah, it's an interesting question, isn't it? And I think the words that comes to my head when I think about leadership first and foremost is facilitation. And I think that's probably partly informed by the fact that my, I suppose, journey through theatre and the arts and into leadership positions has always been through facilitating work, whether that be facilitating work with young people or community groups. But it's always been about creating a space that allows people to thrive and do the best work that they possibly can do. That's what I think of when I think of leadership, like all the nice stuff and then, you know, all of the tricky stuff, I guess we can talk about later, or I just like plug my ears and just continue with the niceness.
It's really interesting that I think all of us are facilitators first, and it's like, so to be having a conversation about leadership with a group of facilitators. I saw this definition from Priya Parker. She says that she defines facilitator as two jobs, and one is to host the gathering. And I love that, like, as that actually it's about bringing the people together and getting all the different identities and being inclusive and not leaving people out. So it looks into that. And then the other part is about helping or aiding in the thing people don't want to talk about, like noticing that and trying to have the conversation. And I was like, because when I think about leadership, there's so much stuff that you can go into and it can feel like really about power and put yourself on a pedestal and it's all of this focus. And actually, when I break it down to, well, if actually I just focus on these two jobs, I can host the gathering and I can help us talk about difficult things, then it feels more achievable to me.
Oh, I love
and I
that.
Guess I do that through my work. But there's something about that is about power, and how do we use that, and when do we step into our power, and when do we actually allow others to take the space? And I think that's what I'm not seeing as much, say, outside of theatre spaces, of like how power is used and it feels abused and it feels hogged and not shared. And like, why aren't there more women in those rooms? Why aren't there, like, all of these questions we go, oh, how are these leaders being trained? But actually, like, in my teaching, I really think that we all need to see ourselves as leaders. You can't see yourself as a participant or you are all future leaders who make decisions. And I think that helps people step into that power more.
Yeah, completely. And I think there's something really useful about particularly our generation of leaders that are coming in at the moment, is that actually there's like this real rejection of the idea of this one singular genius. I think there's an appreciation that we have, which is, you know, we know our shortcomings, and we're quite comfortable with accepting our shortcomings and knowing what we're good at and what we're not good at, and how we can work with other people to ensure that all of those things are being served, and it not having to all be about this one figurehead. But you know, also the buck does stop somewhere, and I think that's an important thing to acknowledge. But it feels much more shared.
Do you remember a moment in your time, in your career, where you felt like there was space being shared, that you were able to sort of like enter, you were able to take up space? Do you remember, like, the other way around, I suppose, a leader that allowed you to feel like you had a space and a voice?
I think my whole theatre initiation was through the National Youth Theatre, and I joined there at 15. And I was a course assistant, so I was assisting somebody else, and they have this training. And it was the first year that they decided to bring in a psychotherapist to come and support the assistants, because they were holding a lot. And her name was Delma Walsh. And I found her so threatening at first. And I remember saying to her, like, it's all right, I've got friends and parents who I can speak to, so I won't be having these conversations. I don't know why I felt so threatened by the thought that I thought she'd be analysing me or working me out. She's like since been, for me, the most inspiring kind of friend and like leader. And we then delivered all of the training for about 12 years for all the facilitators together. So she's older than me, but the way that she shared space with me, and I guess I was approaching it, bringing my theatre background and bringing play and all of that. And she would bring the analysis. And so we would co-facilitate these leadership programs for about 12 years together, and designed trainings. And I think that's been one of the biggest influences on my style as a facilitator. She really made me self-analyze and think reflectively and look at situations differently, and has always really shared space and acknowledged that what I bring is so different to what she brings, and that we need each other in that kind of training.
As a part of a program called the Artistic Director Leadership Program, which was a collaboration between 20 Stories High here in Liverpool, and Teatro Fonzi, and Talawa and Freedom Studios, and they each offered like a 2-year associate director job for people in each of those companies, but then also in partnership with RTYDS and ITC, I think. I think there were 30 of us in total of young leaders of colour, global majority leaders, who took part in these workshops and training sessions, like monthly, I think they were. And actually what that did is it opened me up to like such an incredible network of people that I hadn't met and didn't know. To this day, we still support each other and collaborate and work with each other. And I think the thing that felt really powerful to me about those sessions in particular is that some of them were really challenging. So often we would go to these spaces and people wouldn't quite understand what this group was or what this group was for. It's just like these 30 global majority artists rock up to a building and people, didn't really know how to take us a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. But the way that like RTYDS in particular and ITC adapted to us bringing some of those complications or issues to them was really wonderful. And actually they just provided the space for us to talk and be heard in a really meaningful, useful way that then impacted the rest of that program. And actually it was the first time that I'd been a part of one of those programs. You know, everyone's been part of those programs or schemes where you just go, you know what it is? Like I'm getting what I need out of this thing, but I know that it's like deeply flawed in the way that it's set up. Sure. But actually this was, it was really beautiful to be held in a way that felt like we were really valid and noticed, and our experiences were really taken into account and allowed to have those conversations.
Yeah, that's gorgeous. So did you move up then from London, Nathan, to go and do that at 20 Stories High? Is that where you came from?
No, so I was in Nottingham for a couple of years. I worked at the Nottingham Playhouse for a couple of years as their participation officer, I think it was.
Yeah.
So I was doing lots of work with young people and directing youth theatre, and my participation department was headed up by Fiona Buffini, and she also used to program the studio space there. But while she was directing work, she would sort of hand over those programming duties to me to program the studio. Like I had no idea, like absolutely no idea what I was doing. And it's probably quite irresponsible actually, but it was really...
Who does though?
Yeah, yeah. Who does? Well, and that's what I learned. Do you know what I mean? Like who does? And a bit like you were saying, Kane, like I was sort of spiraling and I sat down with the exec, Stephanie Sir, to just like say, can you give me a crash course in producing, please? I was like incredibly intimidated. But what she did is just like open up a whole new world to me and an understanding of being able to program and facilitate work coming into that space. So yeah, it was just that diving in head first and then being like, who can I ask for support and help to understand this thing? So I was in Nottingham for a couple of years and then moved up to Liverpool 8 years ago now, so I've been there for eight years.
Nice.
To work with 20 Stories High.
That's a great motto though, that thing about just diving in and then asking once you're there, because I think so often when you're from the global majority, but also as a woman, like you almost feel like you have to know 100% of the criteria for a job, especially if it's a leadership position, before you even attempt to go for it, let alone getting it. But actually, the more I've moved through my career as a leader, I've had that same mentality, Nathan, about like, I don't feel like I know right now, but once I get it, I will, and I'll find the right people to help.
Exactly what you said, Gitika. There's, imposter syndrome times a million, but also just like having not even the confidence, even if you don't have the confidence to do it, just like forcing yourself to say what you need to be able to fulfill that role or thrive in whatever that position is and be like, this is the things that I need set up around that.
That's where the conflict comes, because actually
yeah.
we then by ask, and I think a lot of people from the global majority do voice what they need because we don't know. And then it shines a spotlight on going, you don't know either. And that's seen as threatening.
Yeah.
As going, oh, they're shaming us. And it's like, no, actually, like, why can't we just begin from an honest place of like, where are we? I don't know how to do this. Can somebody show me? And then it's a maze at times. I found in my work, it's a maze to understand a system. And you're like, right, nobody knows. I'll make my own.
Yeah. But actually, I think when I've been the most vulnerable or open as in a position of leadership, that's when like I feel like the most exciting things actually happen.
Shall we move on to the next question?
Yes.
Which we touched on it slightly earlier, Nathan, you'd mentioned it, but we were just curious and we're not leading at all, but just, is the idea of serving artists and audiences problematic? And if so, why? But also, it's fine if you're like, no, I don't think it's problematic. I want to serve. That's my duty. How do you feel about that term, serving artists and audiences?
Problematic. and maybe I've been spending a lot of time in my workspace at the uni recently, and that it feels like a customer-server relationship at times. And it is so problematic because my job isn't to please you all the time, like as we're making, or my job is, I have a voice and I want to share my voice, and it might be to find some allies, or it might be to challenge the status quo, or it might be to unearth something I'm seeing from research, and therefore it's not just to do whatever you need. Like I'm so like grateful always whenever an audience chooses to spend their time. Like the time is the most precious thing that we've got, and to spend 2 hours or so in your company with your people, I think is so sacred. But it's not. You might not like our work. It might confront you in a way. So I then think there's this unvoiced obligation or like contract that happens when you come and you join and watch a piece of work. And I don't know where we put the, I'm offended by this. Like,
sure.
I don't know where you do put that actually. Yeah, take it home and have a think about it. You know what I mean? But what do you want to come from this? We never work again because a piece of work hit a nerve.
Of course, it's dangerous. It can be dangerous.
So I'm unsure of like, and actually, I've sadly had to teach students that like, if you can sell out a theatre, you'll probably get us back, because at the minute and the times that we're in, we are like, you know, we're not taking those big risks on new work or anything. If it's got a famous person in, if it's a name of a show that is well known. Or unless the company are really like have their own flavor and are really well known, it's like they get the commissions and we're not taking the risks on newer work or on new artists that kind of everybody feels like they're changing themselves to appease everybody else. And then we're losing that real authentic voice of what do people really want to say? And and then we make boring, kind of dulled down kind
of
work.
Totally. One of the things that we're studying in this sort of research and development phase of this programme with the Moshe is like the idea that there is this sort of Eurocentric dramaturgy that like it becomes a lens that people's work has to sort of get filtered through. And then I also feel like people are losing authentic voice sometimes through that, knowingly or unknowingly, from that dramaturg or that literary department. And It's becoming inauthentic, I think, in my opinion. And I just wondered what you guys thought about, dramaturgy and where that sits.
Bouncing off of that, Gitika, and also what Kane was saying before, I think there's, I don't think we have to, often we do, but I don't think we have to lose our voice or authenticity in order to, like, serve people wonderful things. So when Kane was talking earlier about that drama therapist, that Kane was you were saying you're a bit hesitant to engage with that drama therapist didn't then go, okay, well, actually I'm gonna changed my practice to think about how I can offer something to Kane who doesn't really want to talk to me. Mm-hmm. Actually, they stay true to what their practice is. And then you really found the value in that.
Yeah.
So I suppose I'm really, yeah, I hope that artists can continue to feel encouraged to make the work that is true to themselves, because that is a brilliant thing to offer the world. And like you say, otherwise it just has become stale and less authentic. But I'm also super aware that that's easier said than done. Do you know what I mean? Like if you're talking to students about, you'll be asked back if you sell that place out, and knowing that actually that responsibility can't all be on you as an individual artist to build the audiences to sell that place out. But again, you know, we all need to put food on our table and pay our incredibly high light and electricity bills. You know what I mean? So how do you, how do you continue to ask people to do that whilst you know that there are real financial implications for that?
I was gonna say, do you feel like your responsibility there, I guess, is different as a director and then as a creative or artistic director? Do you feel that relationship is different with audiences?
I think we have to work with audiences. Like, it's not in spite or against audiences. Like, often I think people, and even when I go and see work, I sit there and I go, who's this for? Like, who is this? Like, if I, and then when you ask and you go, it's for everyone. And I'm like, it's not for everyone.
Yeah. How can it be?
And who is your everyone? When you think in your head, everyone, who are you imagining? Like, imagine what are the ages, identities, like qualities of those people? Because if I'm directing a show for 5-year-olds, I make very different choices for if I'm making a piece of work for an elderly people's home.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So it's not for everybody. And I don't know if people have actually thought when they are making the work about, I think they've at times know what they want to say or what they want to, but they haven't thought, who is it for? Who am I making this for? Mm-hmm. And that really informs how we chat. Like, if it's to educate or if it's to challenge an audience, then maybe having all the allies in the room isn't the right audience.
I
it's
agree.
Not to say that they're not included, but it wasn't for you. And that I learned this from that drama therapist person who from Delma, and she made me think about it, protect like the reviews and all that's to protecting yourself by going, but Kane, you knew who it was for, and what did you, was it for that person who said those words? I think it's so important we consider that audience and who they are, not just anybody.
And then I guess an interesting thing there is if you're making work with the idea of challenging somebody, like challenging a particular group of people, how do you find that you're able to bring them into that space to like to trust you know the process and to trust the work to in order to put themselves in a position where they're like open to being challenged?
I think when you talk about audiences, I think there's two different things. One is what Kane was saying there about making, who are you making the work for, I think is really important. And I'm a strong believer that the more specific a piece of work is, actually the more global the reach is of it. We love stories, we love telling stories. And if you can tell a really detailed, wonderful, beautiful, specific story, I think that will reach and resonate with people that might not identify with that particular lived experience or whatever it is. And then I think the other thing about how do you bring people into a space to be challenged, I think is really difficult. I think I'm really interested and excited by the idea of like comfortable radicalism, if that even is possible or allowed to make sense.
There's a term.
But where is the place that you're meeting those? What is that you are doing that allows you to meet people at a place that feels somewhat comfortable, maybe not completely comfortable, but to challenge that work in a really meaningful way to allow them to think about how work can be made in a different way.
There's something about being in relationship, like with your audience. Like the Puppy Show makes work in a very specific way. We tell our own, we use our own stories, but we spend years researching. Mm-hmm. So, and our research comes from meeting people, working with people. So we would build a trust with a community. Like the show we're working on at the moment, and it's about trying to find what the, like, what would it be called? Like the center or the stimulus right at the heart of like a community. What is the issue that we're not talking about? And then how do we bring in all those different communities to go, we need to talk about this? And that's where, but then it means that the research is actually going somewhere and engaging with lots of different community groups and seeing what's out there, going to meet in the men in the allotments going and seeing the young mums carers group going and like and really going and getting to know and building a relationship and trusting so that then when we go, could we ask you to come to our performance? They kind of already are in relationship and go, yeah, I'd love to. I've contributed towards it. I feel like something I've offered is a part of this work.
Wow. Yeah. And I think that's why I feel conflicted with that question about, you know, serving artists and audiences. Is that problematic? I don't want to conflate offering a service to just appeasing. And I think what Kane just described there is like what an absolutely beautiful service that the Papi Show are offering all of those people in a way to connect and make art and play and have joy. Like that's a beautiful service that is being offered by the Papi Show. But it doesn't mean that they aren't challenging those people that are taking part in those workshops and stuff.
It creates a structure that actually maybe isn't helpful to the way that different people work, because I suppose the structure that you're talking about, Kane, is actually like the artist and the audience is in community rather than in sort of like, I don't know, opposition or tension or like, you know, separate. So I think that, at the heart of it, it's looking at the structure. So it's, really, really beautiful, deep.
But I guess that is a very different approach, isn't it? Like I've really unpacked like the traditional format of how we make work and blah, blah, blah. And I've found my own style that I like with my team. But it's like, it's because I'm not interested in it being about me. I want to collaborate. Like the only reason I ended up making the company was because I wanted to work with my friends. I wanted some like autonomy to make decisions and not be like at the mercy of hoping I get picked by a director to do their movement for a moment.
Sure.
I was like, I really just want to be in rooms with people and work together. And I guess that's our approach. We work with the audience. They co-made it with us, you know.
Yeah.
Incredible. And because one of the questions, I'm saying it in the wrong order, but I think it kind of relates a little bit. One of the questions is about the things that, what do you enjoy making? So is a lot of your work, Kane, does it follow that same structure? Is it project dependent? Like, and also with that and the same to you as well, Nathan, what kind of things do you enjoy making?
I guess our work is joyful, you know. I've got, the first show that I made was called Boys and it was with 10 men and they were men from the global majority. And because I felt like I often see, and it's really important that we protect those spaces that are for just one identity, but actually the world is complicated and it looks like all of the difference that is even in this room now. You know what I mean? That you go, this is what the world is, and I don't see difference represented. It's like, this is the black space, this is the queer space. Like, and actually, what about when it's centered in a different way? And when you bring those people together, I just do not want to be focusing on the moment in their life that was traumatic. I have no interest. I want to dream up a future where it all could be different. Like, so therefore I want to see, I love making stuff that makes people beam. I want to see them like exuding all of their fantastical exuberance, you know. I want to capture those moments and go, I was there, that moment happened, that person sang their song for the first time and and we all wept. Like, that was a brilliant piece of art that I saw.
But yeah, beautiful, beautiful. And what about you, Nathan? And you, Beth? I'm interested.
Really similar, which is probably quite boring. But I suppose like my guiding light for making work and the work that I like to make is about hope. Like, what is the hope that we're offering people that are engaging with this piece of art in whatever form they are? Like, where does the hope lie? And that doesn't mean that you can't explore like really difficult, gritty, tough things or subjects or whatever it is. But yeah, what's the hope that we are offering? Particularly because particularly when I'm writing work, I suppose I'm writing work that is somewhat adjacent to or close to experiences that I have, which then tend to center global majority people. Like, what is it that I'm offering us when I make that work, but also what is it that I'm leaving people who aren't us with? And I don't want people just to come and watch my work and be like, oh, isn't it so tough? Like, that feels like the worst version of anything that I could ever make. there's people walking away and like feeling pity for a particular experience. And I just, yeah, I like humor. I like comedy. So to be in a space where people are laughing, community, like I don't think there's any better feeling in the world. Mm,
beautiful. Do you have an answer, Beth?
I'm trying to find like a common thread between all the work that I make. It's quite like very different, but like no project I think is the same, but I think that idea of collaboration I think feels really, really, really key. But I think what maybe guides me is curiosity and learning something new. And I think that's what I love about making new work for me, is about like finding a new perspective on the world that I didn't know about before. And I think that's the beauty of having like a diverse, you know, group of people in a room. And I guess that's what is constantly pushing me forward. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about you, Gitka?
I think it's a similar thing. I'm finding it hard because there's no thread through my work. And I think that's because of the grind. And also sometimes you just have to say yes to jobs because, you know, money and stuff. And of course, with every job that I do, my identity does bleed into that work naturally, whether it's intentional or not. Yeah, I think what I'm enjoying, like when I first started out, like I did get all of the players that were talking about trauma. Like the first show I ever made was about forced marriage in South Asian communities, which was just like, whoa, it was like such a great show to work on and so important to be talking about. But the more that I do, the more that I realise actually for me, that's quite heavy for me. And I don't know if I have headspace to make those shows a lot. Like now I'm starting to book more gigs that are like more general and not identity specific, like a Christmas show that is for kids and is about joy and is about just telling a story really well. Mm. I want to make work where my parents can come and watch it and like my wife can come and watch it who don't go to the theatre at all and just have a really good night out whilst trying to say something political. That's the sort of stuff that I enjoy making.
I always think that, like, the... because I guess we do have... often it can feel like we have no choice, but we do have choice. And we can choose to go, do I want to do this or not? And I always now think, do I want to spend half my year or 6 months? Or do I want to be spending it thinking about this topic or theme? Or do I want to be in rooms with those people? Am I going to see those people more than I will see my own family and my best friends this year?
Yes.
Am I willing to do that as a sacrifice? Or my grandparents came from the Caribbean. They sat on a boat for 35 days to get here. Did they do all of that so that I would be this miserable person thinking about, like, no, they didn't. It's my absolute right and to lean into going, no, I'm not doing that. I don't want to. It's really empowered me to say or to think more consciously about what I say yes to and what I say no to, because maybe I've had those experiences where actually being as messed up as I was and my confidence knocked down and all of that from being in certain spaces, it wasn't worth it, actually. It wasn't worth being able, you know, how I had to sacrifice myself. So I'm fully on board when I say yes.
That's
good.
And it's really healthy. And it's interesting what, Gitka, you were saying about, like, the grind. And I suppose, I don't know if it feels different for you, Gitka, as a director who's bringing those projects together, as opposed to, I suppose, Kane, someone asking you to come into their room to do some movement direction, is that sometimes you justify it. And then I give the same advice that Kane gave just there, but I often don't, or I haven't taken that advice for myself so many times, because I just go, well, actually, I don't know how I'm paying those bills next month, so I can't say no to this thing, is the way that I rationalize it. And then I think about, okay, what can I do to like make that room or that space like the best space possible for me and the artist involved in that. And you know, that I might have like a wonderful month or something, and then after it I'll be like, oh my gosh, that was pretty heavy that I just sat through all of that. I wish I just didn't. Yeah, it's difficult to turn down work. It's always been difficult to turn down work in this industry, and it feels particularly difficult to turn down work in this industry at the moment.
I agree.
When you know that so many people are struggling to find any work at all.
Yeah
totally. It's so true. And there's also no, like, talking as a freelance, I've been freelancing for, I want to say, 8 years now. As much as theatres and stuff ask for feedback once you've left, there's actually no, for me, I never create space and time for me to like decompress or to reflect. You can obviously talk about it with your mates and, you know, your peers and stuff like that. But everyone's so busy. It just feels like everyone's so overworked at the moment. People have like don't have capacity for themselves and their own families, let alone you and the bad experience that you might have just had. Maybe one action I can do for myself going into this next year is like not booking back to back if possible, and allowing like a week or 2 weeks or maybe even a month if possible to have some decompression time.
Yeah,
for sure.
So I suppose off the back of this, and like I think everyone's starting to like envisage changes or envisage their ideal way of working, the question is, what does success mean and look like to you? And that could be like just a space to think about, like, how would your ideal year of work be structured? Because I guess that's maybe a version of success where you're living the life that you are really choosing. So maybe Nathan, start with you. What does success mean and look like to you?
Do you know what? I genuinely don't know, and I think it changes frequently. I feel like I set myself goals, and then I either achieve or fail at that goal. I suppose in the context of this conversation around leadership and what it means to be in a leadership position, I think for me, I think success is when people are willing to engage with you to make things better. That feels like a successful space to be in as a leader. Because I know that when, you know, no one's ever going to get everything right, but actually if people feel engaged with whatever it is that you're doing, and it feels like you are doing things for the right reasons and people want to engage to make things better, that feels successful to me. So maybe that's it. Maybe that's my idea of success, is like to always have the ability and want and desire to explore new things, I think is probably where I always want to be.
I think for me, there was something about, and like we're really in this period at the Puppy Show of like, I'm really questioning every aspect of like, what we do. It feels like I built the company out of a need, and actually the tools I used 10 years ago to set it up don't work anymore, and I need to find some new tools. Last year was our 10th anniversary, and we had the biggest like year. We performed all our shows, we did a big national tour, we did so much, and at the end of it I felt the most broken, alone, no money, like further than my friends. It was like, and I was questioning, was it all worth it? You know, was this all worth it? And it felt like, because there's such a lack of resources out there, that therefore the only way is to like cut and chip. And actually it puts the strains on the relationships. And if I work with my very best friends, I don't want to be heavy on them and make it hard and can't pay them enough. And everybody's feeling a little bit like put out. And I was like, we need to just pause for a moment and really think, how are we doing this? Because we work mainly with people from the global majority. It's like, why am I giving them the scraps and the short changes? Because I got given the scraps, and that like, that nothing is really, the ripple effect is actually more harm than healing. So I started to just go, I need some space. And it doesn't surprise me that I'm the course leader at a big university that is packed full of resources, because I was like, I just can't be in this space of lack all the time. Not enough, not enough. We haven't got this. Could you do it? Could you make a this? It's like, we can't do it on that. And if you can't meet us with what we need, we're going to have to just pause and say no.
Yeah.
So I've been thinking, maybe it like, is the Puppy Show a residency for 30 artists? And we do a week at the start of the year, we do a week at the end of the year, and you go, just come on that. It will be filled with inspiration and joy. And then we all go back into our regular lives and we're topped up for the year, like you've had your fix. And you go, so I'm really thinking about what is it? But there's something about what, like walking with people, like, and make it being creative and making stuff and learning together, that is really at the heart and at the center of the Puppy Show. And it being about offering opportunity to people who may not, it's not their birthright to walk into this industry. Mm-hmm. So therefore, some of that looks like success, but there's, for me, it's about like the long haul and the journey and being in people's kind of lives and making kind of an impact, and it not just being about the work I make, but about the work that they make, and they go on to teach, and they go on to, like, I feel like that's what change looks like. But all of that is impossible without resource.
Yeah.
That's so much pressure, isn't it? To be like the majority of the artists that I work with are global majority artists, and I feel like I'm giving them the scraps. Like, does it feel like there's anywhere or anyone that you can share that pressure with? Because I think that's so much pressure to hold as
a
leader who's built their own company like you. Like, where does that go?
Well, actually, there isn't that much support if you've got your own company, because I don't belong to a venue. So therefore, sure, they want to raise money for their thing, not for your thing.
Yeah.
So it's often like me and the rest of my team up through the night writing arts councils, then going to our day jobs, and then we didn't get 6 arts councils. We've not been funded for I think 3 years now. We've received 0 funding. So it's like, it is genuinely scraps we're getting. We're like all saving up, doing a workshop and trying to put that in a bit of a fund here so that we can, you know what I mean? So I don't come from a theatre background, so it's not like I've got all of these producers who I could call on. It's like when people go, oh, yeah, well, you just need to, it's like, what? Who? I don't know where to go. I don't know. We found our own way, but that way now has kind of, it's got to its like limit. It's like we need a different approach or way or more support, really. So it's, I think I'd love to share it out, but I'm sure if I'm one company, all the other ones that are out there are equally facing the same kind
of course.
Struggle.
It sounds like the model is
broken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it feels like, I'm hearing this story a lot. It's very, very frustrating, and kind of, it's frustrating to hear that a company that's making excellent work, that's been making excellent work, is having to sort of like almost evolve away from that, which, you know, obviously that's the right thing to do right now, because that is the way of protecting yourself and protecting the people that you're working with. But
I also see the positive, because I'm like, actually, in like design terms, we'd say, let's do a redesign. And I think that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Like, I'm so excited by what is the redesign then that we could do. Now we've got 10 years of history here.
Yeah. Yeah.
All those people that care about us, we're redesigning from a better place than where we started.
Of course.
What's the possibility of what now can we do if we've got these limitations, but now we've got so many new, like, other opportunities? How do we redesign all of the ways we do things so it can serve us in a different way?
Yeah.
And because everyone that's a part of the company is like gone on that journey with you, I think there's like an excitement in that redesign. Do you know what I mean? Whereas actually, if your model, you know, back to the thing about service, if it was always about serving people, then it's a different, more difficult thing to do and say, this is the new version of what the Pappy Show is. Whereas actually, there's like a real collective investment and engagement in the company with everyone that you work with, that it's, here's a new thing that's going to serve us in the best way, rather than I have to explain to these people why we're doing these things or why we're doing less. It's
useful, brilliant, again, to like be just moaning about how hard it is. And like, actually, thinking of a redesign is so rich. Like, it gives us so much more. It gives us a future. So I'm excited by the redesign.
And I think it brings you back to leadership, which is what kind of, I guess, something that we started with, that you're really demonstrating that leadership is about listening.
Beautiful. Well, I think that rounds this episode off. Thank you so much, Kane. Thank you so much, Nathan. It's been so beautiful talking to you both. Reach out to me.
If you love this episode, then please do share it with your friends and maybe even leave a cheeky review.
And for more of Tell Them, don't forget to subscribe and follow us on our socials for episode drops.
Join us for episode number 4. We're going to be chatting with Testament and Jay Zarenti-Nikide.